So thank you very much, Professor Stanford, for that. I will be commenting on the age issue, Moyad. Thanks for raising the question. It's a good one, and it's a very hot topic. I've only got 160 slides to cover in about 50 minutes, so bear with me if I talk quickly. I tried to pare them down last night, and I added a few more, so I thought I better stop. So I'll do the best I can. So it's all about when couples come to us to try to have a baby, we say, first of all, we want you healthy and we want you happy. And you got to be loving each other, because a child is a fruit of your love. And if there's not a lot of love there, your fertility is really going to be compromised. And we've seen that all the time. So our goal is happy, healthy couple, healthy baby. And if you're lucky, you might get leprechauns. They're my three little ones, James, David and Maureen, and thank God I've been fortunate to be blessed with children. I never thought it would happen to me. I've seen so many people with infertility. So with the restorative reproductive medicine approach, our view is the basic view with fertility culturally and within medicine. I'm a GP by training, and we're often in the ideology that fertility is a disease that needs to be suppressed or treated. If you get sterilized, you get fixed. And there's this whole negative view to fertility until you actually decide you would want to have a baby. And the view with fertility care, NAPRO technology, restorative reproductive medicine is that fertility is a normal, healthy process that we can understand and, in fact, live in harmony with it, rather than this sense of enmity between our fertility and our lovemaking as couples. The restorative approach restores normal function and inherently avoids techniques that are suppressive, destructive or circumventive. So straight off the bat, we don't do IUI, IVF or ICSI. And you kind of say, well, why bother? It's like trying to treat fertility with one hand tied behind your back. And it's because restoration matters. And Keats can say it better than me. A thing of beauty is a joy forever. Its loveliness increases, and it will never pass into nothingness. And it's because it's worth doing. And it's a real treasure, more treasure than these works, more precious than these works of art. And it's something that we should value and respect and do everything we can to restore it to the beauty that it's supposed to have. We use the best medical approaches possible. We go for clinical evidence, looking at symptoms and signs. We perform the appropriate investigations. We establish multiple diagnostic categories and multiple treatment strategies. All of these things are improved with the Creighton Model Fertility Care Chart. Without the chart, it's like trying to find your way to this conference without a map. We did that deliberately just so you'd appreciate how important the chart is. But in addition, we look for the assessment of outcome. And it's not just we apply the treatment and we're done. We have an ongoing assessment of the outcomes. Is this working? Are we doing better? And we keep modifying and changing our treatment. The NAPRO technology that I apply today is completely different in many respects compared to where I started 13 years ago. And it's because by listening to patients and looking at those that we keep failing, and we say, what are we missing here? Sometimes we give treatment to patients and they feel worse, and somebody comes in ill and we make them even sicker, and we kind of go, that's not what we intended to happen. So because of that, we've started to develop a lot of techniques that improve the couple's health. Again, if you want to be pregnant, get you healthy and get you happy. If we give you treatment that makes you ill, our outcomes are going to be worse. So the thinking behind what we do, it's supported by our medical training, our 6 years of undergraduate medical training, our postgraduate experience looking at published clinical studies, our ongoing clinical experience, common sense, and ongoing critical evaluation and audit of the care that we're providing. So it's not just simply, well, what do the published studies say? Yes, that's a part of it, but you have to be more broad in your thinking when you're approaching these problems. And by doing that, it allows you to discover new treatment strategies, your eureka moment where you go, wow, this is something that's really going to improve our outcomes. We've had several of those over the years by the discovery of endorphin stimulation with low-dose naltrexone, antibiotic treatment to treat chronic endometrial infections, dietary strategies, changing diet, adding nutritional supplements, and We're looking at immune-modifying strategies, and we can do all of this in a way that supports and cooperates with the procreative potential that's already there. So we enhance that and we empower it, and it works better. So yes, published studies are important, and there's a serious need for us to inform our peers of the new evidence that we're finding through publications in medical journals, and this is what we're trying to do with restorative reproductive medicine and the whole iNEST project that Professor Stanford mentioned. With NAPRO technology, there are many publications regarding the medical and surgical techniques that we use, but they're not that widely known or widely applied. The textbook, as Professor Stanford said, in many ways is like our Bible of here's all the science behind it. It's based on about, I think there are 1,200 references to the published literature, and it's based on published evidence, but the term NAPRO technology has only been published in the medical literature once. There's another publication on the way coming from Canada, a female GP, and her figures are better than mine. It's really annoying, but at least we can actually apply some of these criteria to say, well, look, our population was more difficult, okay? So, but they're about roughly the same. So on one level, we might boast and say we're doing really well with NAPRO technology, but on another level, this first publication, I hope, will be the worst figures you'll ever find published for NAPRO technology, because these were the first 4 years of practice. These were before we had access to really good surgical intervention. This is before we did all these other things to improve women's health. And even with all of that, the crude live birth rate is still 25%. And in many ways, the reason that it looks good is because, without being offensive, is just that the treatment that's already there really isn't as effective as everybody would like it to be. It's not like you're competing with an 80 or 90% success rate with IVF. The success rates are comparable to what our crude live birth rate is. So people look at restorative reproductive medicine, NAPRO technology. I was thinking we're going to have a lot more GPs here, and I was going to give some insights into what you can do even with minimal knowledge of NAPRO technology. So that's what I want to say. Well, what can you do today after you leave this conference that'll help you to deal with your patients? The topics we're looking at would be premenstrual syndrome, postnatal depression, male factor infertility. You can do something when you leave here today if you're a doctor and you can prescribe. Even if you're not, there are things we can recommend as well that'll be able to help with all of these things. When it comes to miscarriage, though, and infertility, you really need the help of a NAPRO doc for this one. Premenstrual syndrome, it's not pretty, but it's more than unpleasant for the woman and the couple that have to struggle with it. These are all the negative symptoms. We've also found that it is associated with infertility as well as miscarriage. And these are the typical symptoms out of 147 couples, women, that Dr. Hilders was evaluating in Omaha. So these are the typical symptoms: irritability, bloating, teariness, fatigue, depression, carbohydrate craving. Typically, the symptoms would last for 9 days before the period begins, where the woman is just not herself. In the general population, premenstrual syndrome can affect about maybe 25% of women from moderate to severe type of premenstrual symptoms. So 75% of women don't have it, and about 25% do. But in the infertile population, it's like 90% of women have the premenstrual symptoms. So there's a connection there. Our view is we want to eradicate your premenstrual syndrome, and then you'll feel better, and you get better fertility outcomes as well. Studies have failed to demonstrate the superiority of progesterone over placebo. So one of the main treatments we do for premenstrual syndrome is progesterone treatment. But the Association of Professors of Gynecology and Obstetrics in the United States tell us all of the published studies show it doesn't work. And that's the official wisdom. When Dr. Hilders, and this is in his textbook, when he looks at the nuts and bolts of these studies, he says, well, all of those studies don't work if you don't give it in a timed fashion. And the only study that did show significant improvement was where they looked at urinary hormone assessment. And they found that if they gave the progesterone in a timed fashion and accurately targeted the luteal phase, there was significant improvement in premenstrual syndromes and PMS. But if you look at all of the studies, they say, well, look, overall it didn't work. Because it's the type of study, the way that it's given is critical to the effectiveness. So the current thinking is you go for Sarafem, which is basically Prozac. And this is the effectiveness of Prozac compared to placebo. So you got premenstrual syndrome, and you get marked improvement in symptoms for a small number of people on the Prozac compared to those with placebo. Moderate improvement is a little bit better, and the overall effect, you could say, well, there is some improvement from giving Prozac. But you compare that with hormone treatment from Dr. Hilder's experience, and this is the comparison. Yet the Association of Professors of Gynecology and Obstetrics tell us this doesn't work. All of us who are working in NAPRO know that it works because we experience the gratitude of women and their husbands alike for I'm me again. I can't believe the difference this has made. And it's often one of our positive prognostic indicators when the woman feels so much better. We say, you know, your chances of fertility are going to be better now as well. So it's a win-win. The treatment in these arms is HCG injections in the luteal phase in a timed fashion. Once you identify where the woman is ovulating in a timed fashion, you give HCG injections on days 3, 5, 7, and 9 after ovulation, and you get an 86% improvement. And the other is where you give natural progesterone. So it's certainly it's more than twice as good as Prozac. And these are the numbers when you're looking at women with PMS, how many women have all of these symptoms. The infertile population and those women who are prone to miscarriages have a much higher incidence of premenstrual syndrome compared to the normal population. It is important, despite what current thinking is like. And we know this from clinical practice. But again, one of the hundreds of studies that we can do is on premenstrual syndrome and the benefits of this treatment. You need a chart for this, really, to do it well. To be able to give the progesterone. But by critical evaluation and listening to patients, we've also found other things. There is data linking low endorphins in the luteal phase with worse PMS, and we've targeted a lot of our treatment for endorphin stimulation with the treatment of low-dose naltrexone, and we've remarkably observed, despite the data that Dr. Hildreth has in his textbook, that many women can get huge improvement in these negative symptoms even without hormone treatment or even before they start it. So in clinical practice, what I do for everybody who walks in the door, we're going to make all these slides available online so you don't need to kill yourself writing 100 notes. We'll have links at the IRM website so you'll be able to get all of these slides. And apologies for the graphs that were missing from Professor Stanford's slides. We'll have those online available for you as well, so with the references. But simply what we do, diet, it has a massive impact. You can do a straight elimination diet, eliminating milk, wheat, and sugar, and some women get their lives back with that. Exercise is a natural way of improving your endorphins, but a more effective way I found in clinical practice is low-dose naltrexone, 2 milligrams for week 1, 3 milligrams for week 2, and usually maintain at 4.5 milligrams, and omega-3. Now, for me, looking at couples coming through, I think we're getting like 70% significant improvement in the premenstrual symptoms with this. And I think what you'll find here is the marked group is going to go way up. Now, this is just with the hormone treatment. If we incorporate this with the additional strategies of diet, endorphin stimulation, and omega-3, we're going to find the marked improvement group. I think we're going to be up near the 90% plus bracket with that, which is really satisfying for the physician as well as for the patient. Premenstrual syndrome, so you can do these things. What you can't do and never do is give progesterone on day 16 of the cycle, because there's enough published data to show that doesn't work. You have to give it in a timed fashion on day 3 after ovulation. You can prescribe timed progesterone if you give it in a timed fashion. The best way to do that is get the woman to track her fertility cycle. The teachers are listed all over on the website at fertilitycare.net. Accurately identify the peak, take it in a timed way, and if you need to, refer to a NAPRO doctor to manage it as well. And like Androsteles and the lion, you will experience forever gratitude because it's a real scourge for some women. Postnatal depression. I won't go through all the symptoms. It's bad. It's awful. You feel awful, and you're just completely not yourself with all of these negative symptoms. It affects, on average, about 12% of women. It's more likely to occur if you have a history of depression, and it's more likely in adolescence. Dr. Hilders, from the work that he did, found that this is phase two study for treatment of postpartum depression with intramuscular progesterone, which we have largely abandoned in Ireland in preference for vaginal progesterone. But this is one area where intramuscular is really good, because literally within 2 hours you get a transformation and a relief of the whole cloud of depression that goes with postnatal depression. And five out of these 30 women, all they needed was one injection, and that was it. They were sorted. The other 25 needed additional injections for about 5 days, and he fine-tuned the treatment based on what patients were telling them, say, well, I'm still not right, and he would do some additional adjustments for a small number of those. But by doing that, he got 96% response rate by giving progesterone and tailoring it to the individual. And this is quick. Antidepressants you're taking, it takes you 3 weeks for your antidepressants to work. This is fast. I gave it to a patient on Friday. She was really in a bad way. She came back to me on Monday. I literally did not recognize the same patient. I said to myself, why does she have such a grin on her face? What's she smiling about? And I opened up her chart and said, oh, you're the girl that was depressed. It can be literally that traumatic. There's a graph that you can have where you document all of the negative symptoms. And this is collation. Dr. Hilders is brilliant for research. He's a real detail merchant, far superior than what I do. I do clinical practice, but he really analyzes the data, and you could see he achieves statistical significance. Even though the numbers are small, the changes are that profound. Even with 30 patients, you achieve a high degree of statistical significance in relief of all of these negative symptoms of depression, fatigue, teariness, anxiety, helplessness, as a result of giving this progesterone. So it's quite a profound change. And if you'd higher numbers, I'm pretty confident you'd achieve statistical significance for a lot of these other less common symptoms as well. The overall number of symptoms, the average number of negative symptoms went from 7.5 down to 2.1 out of that group of 30 women, which also achieved statistical significance. So you don't need to be NAPRO trained to give progesterone. This is simple. What we're doing, we give vaginal cyclogest these days. We give it, it's progesterone, 400 milligrams as a vaginal pessary twice a day for 5 days, and then one at night for another 5 days, and then we stop. And we get huge improvement with that. Anyone can do this. You do not need a chart. If the symptoms return, you repeat that treatment strategy. And in our clinical experience, we add low-dose naltrexone, the same as the premenstrual type of treatment, and omega-3, and in fact do consider diet as well. With respect to diet, a lot of the time we do refer to nutritional therapists to help with the dietary strategy. And we often do a food print with Cambridge Nutritional, who are based in the UK, where we look for IgG food antibodies. But the dietary changes, the supplements, the naltrexone, as well as the progesterone, would be the more complete package, and very satisfying for the physician to treat. The results are rapid and profound, literally within hours with intramuscular progesterone and within a day with the vaginal cyclogest, and the patients are literally unrecognizable. I went backwards there. So you'll experience love, joy, gratitude, pleasure, delight, excitement, appreciation from the husbands. And that's not even starting with how the women feel about all of this. But it's incredible, and it's profound, and it's very frustrating, a treatment that is this dramatically effective, that it's not being more widely used. And there's a moral imperative and a burden of responsibility in any physician working in this area: get publishing the data. I don't think there's anything published in peer-reviewed medical journals about this yet, but if we can start to get this data published, there's real difficulty. Hilder's data is great, but there's been real challenges trying to get his data published. Maybe Joe Stanford should go there, and just because with my paper, we were rejected 6 times before it was published, and Professor Stanford said, well, the highest we got to was 10 rejections before we got a publication, but we will get one. We need to be tenacious, get this information out there, because it makes such a difference. Male factor infertility, how low can you go? The WHO criteria for the semen analysis has changed. The previous criteria was a volume of 2 mils with 20 million per mil 50% motility and morphology of 50%. Now we'll accept 1.5 mils as being normal volume, a sperm count of 15 million per mil, and the Kruger strict criteria on morphology, 4% is now considered normal. So, and this is the WHO criteria from 2010. So, and again, don't worry about struggling to write these down. We'll give you the slides. So you get big words for all of these things, and you get lots of couples paralyzed and say, gosh, I've got oligoacinoteratospermia. I'll never be able to get pregnant. And you get these huge worms, and it sounds very serious, doctor, you know. And we do use these big words in medicine, but it's a combination where the oligospermia is the low count, low concentration. Asthenospermia, that there are the motility is poor, they're weak. Teratospermia, that there's they're not formed properly. And a combination of the three gives you the super long word. And then azoospermia, where there's no spermatozoa in the ejaculate. There are additional things that are assessed, such as anti-sperm antibodies, 24-hour survival, and a new thing with DNA fragmentation. And these are new things that that also have a bearing on the quality of the sample. And I'm not going to labour on those too much, but there are things that you can do to improve the DNA fragmentation. It's supposed to be as a result of oxidative stress, as a result of damage by free radicals. And we have some very good treatment for that, and I'll talk about that in a minute as well. So very poor semen, seminal fluid results can still result in successful pregnancy. And often couples are recommended to go for ICSI far too quickly. And they give up on the possibility of natural conception way before they should give up on it. When we collect, or when we recommend couples to collect sperm samples, we recommend the male factor pack, which is a silastic sheath, like a condom that the man wears during intercourse to collect the sample. And there's a reference in fertility and sterility that shows that this is a very good way for collecting semen samples, and often better than the typical way that samples are collected. Treatment strategies, common sense, wear loose clothing, cotton trousers, avoid excessive stress, and a little bit of weight reduction if you're heavy, and a bit of exercise. So the common sense things. And for everybody, we say no smokes, no alcohol, no caffeine, and also go for some of these supplements as well. In addition to the Fertility Plus multivitamin, that we recommend that particular one. We think it's a particularly good one for men. It's a research-based kind of a multivitamin preparation. And we often, made by Dr. Marilyn Glenville, and she was involved with the University of Surrey, where they did a lot of research on your zinc, selenium, magnesium, and all the trace vitamins and minerals that are important for normal fertility. So we usually go for that for about 6 months as well. And we always repeat the semen analysis, usually 10 or 12 weeks after any intervention, to see did we get an improvement. Our treatment strategies, if a man has a low count, we often go for antibiotic treatment with ciproxen. We often try tamoxifen, 20 milligrams a day. And a recent conference in Spain, one of the presenters was talking about the benefits of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory diclofenac sodium. We often give that rectally from day five, and 2 weeks is all you need to give it for. And it has an antioxidant effect as well as anti-inflammatory effect. For motility, again, we consider antibiotics and we consider coenzyme Q10. There was a publication in Fertility and Sterility showing very good effect from coenzyme Q10, but it's got to be a high dose. It's got to be 200 milligrams. The antioxidants, traditionally, this is to improve the sperm morphology. Traditionally, we would have given pycnogenol and vitamin C, but most recently, I've been super impressed with alpha-lipoic acid. There's a book called The Alpha-Lipoic Acid Breakthrough, where it talks about the effectiveness of this treatment as an antioxidant. It's ordinarily made by our livers, and it declines in our 30s, so it's should be in our bodies. It is on the. It starts to go down, and it's around the time where we start to experience more cellular damage and the effects of aging. All I have to say is it's an anti-aging treatment, and I don't have to say any more. They get it straight away. But more than that potential with it is we want the anti-aging effect on the sperm as well as the eggs. I've seen abnormal sperm morphologies of 2 and 3% jumping up to 10 and 12% as a result of this treatment strategy. And I was quite frustrated with pycnogelin in the past, getting very modest results. But the alpha-lipoic acid is one that I think you're going to find very beneficial. And if needed, we do the blood tests as indicated, or refer to a urologist for varicocele repair or chromosome testing. And just to show a few cases of the kind of results that we've seen, this is a couple only 15 months trying. She was age 34. I think he was the same. And his sperm count was less than 5%. The motility was less than 5%. The count was good. So this is asthenospermia. And we did our lifestyle, we did our coenzyme Q10, we did our Fertility Plus and the antibiotics, and they conceived even before I could get a repeat semen analysis. And the challenge when somebody gets pregnant really quickly is they're not really keen to do a repeat semen analysis for you. I'm sure if I push them and say they might, but I find it difficult to ask somebody who doesn't need to at that stage. But to be more scientifically pure, I'd like to know, well, what were the numbers like? Was this a real effect of the treatment? And I often miss that in this type of a scenario. They had a healthy baby boy last February. He was a good 9 pounds, and everything went fine. An interesting thing for most couples that I see with male factor fertility, I would say 75-80% of the time there is an additional female factor as well, usually several female factors. And often one of the best things you can do to improve male fertility is to optimize female fertility as well. Asthenospermia, again, the motility low, less than 5%, a good sperm count. The volume was also a little bit low. And they were advised ICSI, and 15 months trying, short duration by our standards, and they were both around 31. Did a very similar treatment strategy again, and repeated the semen analysis, and it went worse. The volume dropped, the count dropped, the motility was zero after 3 months of treatment, and I got despondent pretty quickly. I said, I think you need to stop. I don't think Napro could help. I'm sorry. And I was even more sorry because she had a laparotomy, major abdominal surgery for adhesions and endometriosis 2 months before getting that. And I was thinking we'd do better in the count. And there's always this balance. I want to do everything we can to help you to conceive, but I don't want to waste your time. And I was just afraid we'd be wasting her time. Then she spontaneously conceived without any fertility treatment the following April, 6 months after she had stopped treatment. And I kind of thought, gee, I gave up a little too quickly in her. And but immediately her hormone levels were right down here. This is her graph during pregnancy, really low hormone levels. And she got pregnant with low hormones, but you can get away with it. But risk-wise, harder to get pregnant, higher risk of miscarriage. And we put her immediately on hormone support. And thankfully, she had a healthy baby boy in November 2009. And remarkably, she spontaneously conceived a second time. And again, we immediately put her on her hormone support to minimize her risk of miscarriage. A large chunk of why she's getting away with this is because she's young. I would hardly ever see this, to take up Moyad's point, in somebody who's in their late 30s. You're far less likely to see this. And I think because she's making loads of alpha-lipoic acid. And so the older ladies, I'm putting on the alpha-lipoic acid to try and get some of this youth effect kicking in. And I'm happy it's safe because it's ordinarily produced in her own bodies. I should have been more persistent. I should have repeated the semen analysis, considered urology referral, maybe a non-steroidal, and certainly where I am today, alpha-lipoic acid. And often you'll get success if you persevere, and sometimes you get success if you quit. I sometimes tell people there's nothing quite like quitting to help you get pregnant because they're free of all of the burden of it, and the only reason that they're having intercourse is because they want to love each other. And when it's a more loving environment, then it's often more fertile. This is a couple, interestingly, I ordinarily don't check the semen analysis if couples have recurrent miscarriages, but they had 3 miscarriages spread out over a period of time. And on 3 separate occasions, he only had occasional sperm, 0 motility, and morphology too few to count. And straight away, you'd say, is he definitely the father of these pregnancies? Because that is so low. And, you know, from a scientifically critical point of view, you have to ask the question. But I'd no doubt in my mind at all, having met the couple, that wasn't even remotely a question. And again, we applied our usual strategies and said, well, let's try these things. In addition, I put him on this these HCG injections, and I referred him to a urologist as well. And we got a modest improvement up to 0.7 million per mil, and you could see that change. Is that a real effect, or is it just natural variation? Well, he did three samples that were all very low before, and I think there is some benefit from the treatment that we gave. It's always difficult to know for sure because there's so much natural variation in samples. And I added antibiotics for him as well because I really wasn't very happy with the overall analysis, and then they conceived 2 months later. A chronic low-grade prostate infection can be really difficult to diagnose and prove. So did we treat something like that? I don't know, because, again, I didn't have the heart task for repeat semen analysis. And they had a healthy baby girl delivered by cesarean section, and thankfully everything went fine. But remember, getting pregnant was only half the battle for this couple. They had three miscarriages before. She was also on female fertility treatment with the whole Napper technology in her chart and all that goes with it, and hormone support throughout her pregnancy. And because my focus is male here, I'm just not going into the details of her case. But it's really important to optimize the female fertility as well. Oligoacinoteratozoospermia, and the count here was 9 million, 29% motility, and 12% normal morphology. By Kruger's criteria, this morphology would now be considered normal, so we dropped one of those, dropped the terato part, and the motility was low, and the count and volume were low. Three samples previously, and they were advised that they were similar to this, and they were told they needed IVF with ICSI to try and conceive. With treatment and the similar interventions, they had a successful pregnancy in 2006, a baby boy, second success in October 2008, and they have a third baby on the way. And this is just to give the headlines rather than the details. That's where the semen analysis was. We did our usual, improved his semen sample. And like Professor Stanford was saying, talking about improving male outcomes, one of the things we did for this guy was a food print test. We found food intolerance for him. And he was wrecked with sinuses and asthma and recurrent chest infections, and his overall health dramatically improved. So get the guy healthy, and his semen parameters will improve as well. Again, she needed treatment every time for them to get pregnant. They did try in between pregnancies on their own with no treatment, and every time you put them on treatment, within a few months they conceived again. So a key factor for his male factor was to treat her as well. Another couple with three failed attempts at IVF ICSI, an account of 6 million with 37% motility, and again, a successful pregnancy. Another couple with two failed ICSI, and again, the starting count was 1 million with 15% motility. And this whole question, how low can you go, we don't know yet. And it's often worth, because I showed you one where there's just an occasionally motile sperm, and only because they had three miscarriages, I decided, well, we should try to do something here. But with treatment, if it stays at that level of an occasional motile sperm, I don't think there's a whole lot we can do. But bar that, lots of suboptimal analysis with big titles of poor semen analysis can do quite well. And again, these also achieved a successful pregnancy and expecting baby number two with really quite severe or significant male factor. We've had three couples who each had 100% sperm antibodies conceived successfully in our program, and a couple recently with 75% anti-sperm antibodies and two previous failed ICSI attempts, who in fact was advised donor eggs because of her poor response to ICSI, also had success with this. In fact, she was aged 43. And I'll talk about that age thing again. It's an issue. And then we've also had two couples with 1% normal morphology achieve successful pregnancies. So quite low samples. The moral of the story is never give up. And that's a frog. So if you persevere, you'll often get the results you're looking for. Premature ovarian failure. This is something that, again, by clinical experience and working with our couples, we've identified strategies that can help in this scenario where they're not even suitable for artificial reproduction because they're not going to make the high number of eggs that you require. And here, she was young considering her FSH. She was 35 and her FSH was 23. Premature ovarian failure, and her cycle was 18 to 30 days. She previously tried Clomid for 5 cycles, IUI for 4 cycles, and IVF twice, produced one follicle in September 06, and despite a flare protocol in October of 07, had no follicles to proceed with IVF. So donor eggs was the only option for her. And what we did for her, we did the food print test with Cambridge Nutritional, looking for these IgG food antibodies. I started to look at this in an experimental capacity about 4 or 5 years ago, not knowing would it be positive or negative. And I can say now, based on clinical experience, that it is a worthwhile thing to do. And if we do identify antibody-producing foods and eliminate them on a population basis, we do get better results. I don't have hard data to show you. I just know from clinical experience, we get the feedback that couples say, I'm feeling so much better, I have more energy, I have less PMS. We find mucus can often improve. So it is a thing worth doing. Rather than the blind diet, because if you go blindly without the antibody testing where we say no milk, no wheat, no sugar, it's a savage, difficult diet and unnecessary for at least 50% of people that you're recommending it to. So I like the food print test. In her case, her cow's milk antibodies were up at 448. And the current guideline is if it's above 30, it's considered abnormal. They recently changed their criteria, but above 30 is now considered abnormal. So she had significant antibody production to cow's milk antibodies, eggs, and a few other foods there. But they were the big ones for her. Milk and eggs, and wheat in her case actually was okay. So she followed our dietary strategy. We put her on supplements, vitamin D3, calcium, magnesium, probiotics, omega-3. We put her on low-dose naltrexone because she fit the criteria for clinical endorphin deficiency. Her blood test on peak plus 7 was low, her hormones, so she needed ovulation induction with bolus HCG to help follicle rupture. With premature ovarian failure, the follicles don't rupture very well. You need a good bolus HCG mid-cycle. We tried that. That was her chart to start off with. And we put her on triple Clomid for 3 days, ultrasound follicle tracking, and the ultrasound showed she got a partial follicle rupture. Her hormones were satisfactory. In fact, her estrogen was far too high. It was up at 2,600, and her progesterone was 75. So we swapped over to letrozole, Femara, dropped the dose a bit, 5 letrozole, and we achieved perfect ovulation induction with that. And within 2 cycles, she had a positive test with optimum hormones. She would also say herself that her health had significantly improved, and she felt that the dairy-free strategy was one of the most important things that she did, and she was probably right. So we followed her hormones throughout pregnancy, and her hormones were great, and everything went fine, and she had a baby boy in April of 2009. So with premature ovarian failure, you can do all of these things. You can recommend a food print test. You can recommend supplements. You can recommend DHEA is one of the new things, and the alpha-lipoic acid. The only doctors are the only ones who can prescribe the low-dose naltrexone, but anyone else here can recommend those things without being medically trained at all. Miscarriages. Where are we? So I'll just look at this couple. It's more than just lost eggs, and it's heart-wrenching for couples who go through miscarriages. And this is looking at a couple who had 6 recurrent miscarriages and no successful pregnancies, starting with us at the age of 40, 6.5 years trying. They came in December of 04. She'd unexplained recurrent miscarriages, a regular 28 to 30-day cycle, did have a uterine septum, which was removed, but continued to miscarry despite that. So this is her chart, and you can see that the chart, her diagnosis, bear in mind, she comes to us and she has a diagnosis of unexplained recurrent miscarriages. We did your clotting studies, we did the thrombophilia screen, we did the chromosomal analysis, we did surgery, we checked your day 21 progesterone, if that's even bothered to be checked, because the interpretation of day 21 progesterone is either you're ovulating or you're not. End of story. And it's clear with 6 miscarriages, well, obviously you're ovulating, so most doctors would conclude there's no point in testing it. Even if she did have it tested, her progesterone on day 21 or peak plus 7 was 35, which is normal by day 21 standards. We know she's ovulating, but what we would say is we suspect you have a poor quality ovulation. So we've got a different interpretation with NAPR technology where we interpret the quality of the ovulation based on the timed blood test 7 days after ovulation, and we use a higher reference range than day 21. So this is really important that our blood test is normal by day 21, but low by the peak plus 7 standards. And straight away, our chart is crying out. And if we have a couple going to a teacher for family planning, and they've never had one miscarriage, and they show a charting pattern like this, any of our teachers would say, don't even try to get pregnant. Your chart looks abnormal. So we can identify at-risk couples before they have the first miscarriage. We don't need to wait for them to have 6 or 3 or whatever number. This is the best preconceptual care, where the chart, even before a blood sample is taken, the chart is suggesting there's an underlying ill health abnormality there. And this is a thing that should have gynecologists jumping for joy, that we have an ability to identify at-risk couples and intervene proactively before infertility or miscarriage is even experienced. And this is, for people who are working in fertility care and not for technology, we can often, I think, you know, become a bit numb to this and say, oh yeah, well, that's obviously abnormal. And we forget just how significant it is to the world that doesn't have a map to find where the conference is on today. That without a map, you really do struggle and find it hard to get there. And the map of the chart is critical to all of this. And this is limited mucus, premenstrual spotting, progesterone deficiency. In addition, we also found she had low B12 and a borderline underactive thyroid, which we treated as well. So our treatment strategy for her, we went for Femara, letrozole, with HCG injections on peak plus 3, 5, 7, and 9. That's a typo, actually. That should be 2,500 units. We don't use 5,000. We gave her vitamin B12, and we gave her L-troxin. And you can see that it moves from this abnormal pattern into the normal pattern, kind of like that. So that's restoration. So pre-restoration and post-restoration. And I just love to see the transition from here's where it was, and now we have the optimum preconception environment. I have a checklist that I run through with people, and I look at the different parameters. I say, let's look at the quality of the menstrual bleeding. Let's look at the mucus quality, the timing of ovulation, the timing of your blood test on day 7 after ovulation, your overall energy levels, your premenstrual syndrome. How are we doing? We run through our checklist, and we say, well, this part isn't okay. We need to work harder here. We need to try something else. If we've tried everything that we know that works, we say, well, maybe we should try something new, and you can experiment in real time with your chart. And this is what the chart enables you to do. So she conceived with an optimum cycle, had a beautiful scan, and we continued hormone support during pregnancy. We kept her on prednisolone as well as eltroxin and folic acid. And she had a healthy baby girl at 39 weeks, delivered by cesarean section. But she could have come to us if she was 34, and she came to us at 40. And it's just terrible that she'd been through so much before she came. And this is the other imperative. There's so many people suffering needlessly that if we can get the word out about what NAPRO technology can do, that we can really help them at this real early stage. There's a real need that this is the system for family planning, for fertility awareness, for the best preconceptual care you can provide for healthy mums, healthy babies, and even helping the father's health. Looking at our data, I did this 2 years ago, so nearly 3 years ago now, it's running a little out of date, but when I looked at the data at this time, these were our more extreme group of couples who had 6 recurrent miscarriages, looking at 15 conceptions from 11 couples in that bracket between January 04 and April of 08. And I'm just going straight to the bottom line because I have a bit of time pressure. And the bottom line is, if the couples were compliant with treatment, our live birth rate was 77.7%, nearly 80% live birth rate. And that's for all the ages, including the 40-year-old couple that I just showed you. That's for every age. And for couples who weren't compliant with treatment, and this is the part that's really important, we use the chart as a probability predictor. It's not an absolute interpreter. It gives a guideline and says it's going to be harder for you to get pregnant, and there's going to be a higher risk for miscarriage. But you could get away with it. So people who decide, well, we don't want any intervention, you can get away with it. So for people who weren't compliant with treatment, they got away with it 16% of the time. But for people who were compliant, we got a successful outcome nearly 80% of the time. So it makes sense to be compliant with it. It's great to give people freedom. I used to worry and sweat about it and say, you can't have intercourse in those days. We're trying to get your chart right. And I used to take ownership over it. And now it's very liberating and say, well, it's your chart. Use it the way you want. You could get away with it. And I'm happy to work with you, but I'll give you the information and I'll work as best as I can. And I'll tell you what I think is probably the best thing to try. We're nearly at question time. Is it 5 minutes? Yeah. Oh gosh. Okay. I thought I'd 15. Okay. So last bit, just on the IVF, and this is just looking at 240 conceptions from couples with a history of previously failed IVF. Now, bear in mind, I'm a GP. I'm not a gynecologist, and this is the first 12 years of practice, and it's really in recent years we've been doing a lot better with our treatment, but. The average female age from these couples coming to me, the average female age in this population, our overall success that I don't have in this data, it's between 25 to 30% on a population basis. If somebody comes to us with a previous history of failed IVF, a previous two failed IVF, on an average, we're between 25 to 30%. Now, you can slice and dice that loads of different ways, but this is baby in hand at the end of it, how many walk out with a baby. Now, if we're just looking at all those who had the babies, what did that population look like? And in fact, I'm going to be working on that data with Professor Stanford to try and publish it. I gave a preliminary preview of it, but we have to wait for people to reach conclusions before it can be definitive. But anyway, the female age was 38 in this group. Average age of 37, 41% were age 38 or greater. 74% never had a previous live birth. So older, unfavourable past obstetric history. They were an average of nearly 6 years trying to conceive, and that's the spread of them from 191 couples conceiving 240 times. The average number of failed IVF attempts was an average of two failed IVF attempts per couple, giving a total of 345 failed IVF attempts. The diagnosis before NAPRO technology, out of all of these couples, nearly 93 were in the unexplained bracket, and then a whole load of other diagnostic things there. And the big change with NAPRO was low progesterone, low estrogen, limited mucus, low endorphins, and other now we're finding chronic low-grade infection, dietary factors, and this whole bracket is expanding more because of the changes in the techniques that we apply. Medical treatment, what all did we do? Well, we gave male treatment, antibiotics. This is going to go way up based on recent experience. And this is the whole range of treatments that we gave. And we got, and remarkably, 15% of these couples got pregnant just with charting alone. Sometimes a couple comes to the chart, they go, oh, this is so great. And they relax, they chill, they unwind, and next thing they're pregnant just with the chart, even before we can complete the hormone evaluation. So even with quite difficult histories, 15% of this group got pregnant just with the chart. There could be a temptation then to say, oh, well, you should exclude those. Well, the chart is an important process of them getting there, and the couples would admit that themselves. How long did it take? 17 of the couples took more than 20 months. But we've lots of couples conceiving well in advance of that time frame as well. So when you're worried about the time factor, lots of couples will get pregnant within the first 12 cycles. In fact, a majority get pregnant within the first year of trying. And as Professor Stanford said, our incidence of twins is really quite low. In this IVF population, previous failed IVF, our incidence of twins was just around 2.3%. And if they got a positive pregnancy test at all, with 240 conceptions, the number of those resulting in live birth was 75%. It was better if you were younger, and as you got older, the incidence of miscarriage was higher because of the aging effect on the eggs. So this is the other concern. As you get older, a higher incidence of miscarriage because of advancing female age. This is a couple who had three failed IVF, and they went public with it, Dr. Eamon McMullen and his wife Louise, when they had success with NAPRO, and that's NAPRO triplets, one at a time, nicely spread out, thank you very much. So this panic, you're 35, everyone's hitting this panic, and it's because when you're looking at the live birth rates, this is the context that I usually articulate it to people in, and this is the live birth rate with IVF from the HFEA data in 2005, I accept it's a little bit out of date. It's about 2 years out of date because of the way it's reported. But you get a 30% live birth rate, 34 or under, and it declines roughly 3% every year. So women at the age of 40, 42 are told you get a 10% live birth rate with IVF. Really, you should do IVF 34 and younger because you're three times better when you're younger. So there's this big push, mid-30s, do your IVF younger and you're going to do better. And there's a certain logic to that. Now, the data for the live birth rates in the general population are hard to get, but the best that I could find, I got this from the NICE fertility guidelines from the UK, looking at the fertility rates in the general population, and there was an 80% live birth rate of the general population in this age group and a 60% live birth rate in that age group, and the rest of the data I couldn't find. Now, maybe somebody else might be better trawling through the data, but I've extrapolated and going with a similar strategy, and I anticipate in the general population, this is the decline in the live birth rates with advancing female age for natural conception based on 12 months of trying to conceive. So in the general population, you don't fit the diagnosis of infertility until you're a full year of trying to get pregnant. And again, the NICE guidelines would tell us you should wait 2 years because for the second year, 50% of couples get pregnant in year two. Which is better than most fertility programs. So you should wait 2 years of natural conception before you give up on it. Well, here's based on 1 year of natural conception and the way. So even at 40 to 42, 1 minute left, I'm nearly there. Even at 40 to 42, you get a 40% live birth rate in the general population for that age. And what we do with fertility care and NAPRA technology, we'll get much, much closer to this figure than what IVF is at because of our restorative approach. Because we deal with all the underlying issues, we run through our checklist, we make sure that everything is working right. Now, we won't get exactly that figure, but we'll get much closer to it than what IVF can get to. And so this idea, well, do IVF quickly because time is marching on and you have to do it quickly. Look, there's a tendency to rush to do IVF far too quickly without taking time to establish the diagnosis and restore optimum conditions for natural conception. And it's only when the conditions are optimum, then you start your count of 12. And sometimes you're only waiting a cycle or two. Often there's no assessment of progesterone, no assessment of ovulation by ultrasound, no laparoscopy, no ovulation induction, inadequate trial of natural conception. I had one couple, they had 8 failed IVF. And we put her on half a Clomid for 3 days, and she started with us at the age of 38, and she had 2 successful pregnancies with us with a history of 8 previous failed IVF attempts. And she had none of this done. She went quickly into IVF to try and get the results quickly. The Cochrane database tells us that IVF has not been shown to be superior to expected management for unexplained infertility. And IVF has only been proven to be effective for blocked fallopian tubes and severe male factor infertility, but otherwise it hasn't been proven to be more effective than conservative treatment. So we tell people, slow down, natural conception rates are superior in every age range, and what's the rush in pursuing an inferior success rate? Yes, we could fail, and we do fail. And when we do fail, people say, well, I still want to do IVF. And say, well, that option is there for you. We've done everything we can. We need to stop. You've got all the good cycles. So if that's a choice you want to make, it may not be one that I would recommend or advise, but if it's your choice to make, and you could pursue the lower success rate if that's where you're at. And if you get the diagnosis and get your 12 cycles, a child is a fruit of your love, not your labour. And there's 2 ways to live your life. One as though nothing is a miracle, and the other as though everything is a miracle. And that's a quote from Albert Einstein.